Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Coming up on the programme, Lawrence Halprin saw gardens through the lens of dance.
He felt that the sense of movement in the environment was a vital part of the design. It was not, otherwise the design would become very decorative, and he wanted his design to be activated.
Los Angeles pays tribute to the late landscape designer. First up, though, this Thursday, it's the deadline for cities who are going to be filing applications to become Amazon HQ2. That's right, the company is looking for a North American city that will house a staff of up to 50,000 people. They want access to an airport, good quality of life, a supply of well-educated techies, and tax breaks. So is this a prize worth winning? There's one city that might know, and that is Amazon HQ1, aka Seattle. We wanted to know how Seattleites feel about being home to Amazon, so we reached out to our fellow public radio station, KUOW. They're launching a podcast this week. It's named Primed, and it's going to be sharing their stories of life as Amazon's company town. Posey Gruner is producer of the series.
You know, the idea is that here in Seattle, when we saw these other cities salivating to become Amazon's second headquarters, we thought they have no idea what they're in for. And, you know, we are not going to look down our noses at the opportunity that we've been given. But at the same time, we know that it's a lot more of a complicated prize than people might be seeing right now. What we've heard from a lot of people is it's not so much the change, it's the pace of change. So in the past 5 years, Amazon has gone from 5,000 employees to about 40,000. In the last year, housing prices here in Seattle have gone up by 13%. So the median home price is now $750,000. That's nearly double what it was 5 years ago.
How much of a physical presence does Amazon have in Seattle?
It has an enormous physical presence in South Lake Union, which is a district that, you know, I remember from 15 years ago, you would drive through and it's just parking lots, car dealerships, really an empty neighborhood. And now it's the Amazon campus. It's lots of new buildings, lots of people walking around who clearly work for Amazon, have their tags hanging from their necks.
They have tags hanging from their necks?
Yeah, they're sort of recognizable because they, you know, I think it's the key card that they wear around their necks that gets them through the various Amazon buildings. But then they go out for lunch and they still have it on and they're very recognizable.
So even though Amazon is looking for HQ2, it is still busy building in HQ1, specifically its new headquarters, which is quite a dramatic piece of architecture. What's the status of that?
So this would be the spheres, these three globes that are sort of in downtown Seattle with a lot of plant matter in them. And we actually went down there the other day just to see the progress. And when we went down there, there was a big crane lifting up a tree and dropping it into one of the top of the globes from up high. So it was a pretty great thing to see. They're still very much in progress, but they're there. You can see them. It's fun to watch.
One hears that it's very hard to talk to people at Amazon. In fact, we know because we tried to get to talk to people at Amazon about all of this, and they're very sort of secretive. So one gets almost a sense of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, you know, with the Oompa Loompas all kind of working away secretly at night. I mean, so Amazon is there. It's omnipresent, and yet it's sort of secret all at the same time. Is that the case?
That's definitely the case.
Wow. So even though all these people are running around with their lanyards on, if you actually went up to them in a coffee bar and said, "And what are you working on?" they're not going to tell you.
They're not really going to tell you. My brother-in-law who works for Amazon, I asked him once, "What's your job?" And he said, "Ones and zeros." And that's about all I got.
And do Amazon's ideas play out in the life of living in Seattle, as in the various innovations they're making in retail or delivery services?
Yeah, I mean, Seattle has the advantage of being sort of a testing ground for the new stuff that Amazon is trying out. And that's part of the culture of Amazon is they try stuff, they spin it up fast, they see if it works, and then either they let it fail or they make it bigger. And one thing that's happening right now is they've opened Amazon pickup stations. you've previously ordered groceries online, you can just drive up and they'll recognize your license plate, I believe, and they'll just bring your groceries out to you, load them in your car, and you're on your way. Other things like Amazon Go, the cashierless grocery store, that has only ever been available to people who work at Amazon when they were testing it out, and I don't believe that it's opened to the public.
So, Posey, that's your experience, which is very, very interesting. But in your capacity as producer of Primed, your podcast that you're launching on Thursday to explore what happens when Amazon comes to your town, you and your colleagues have spoken with other folks in Seattle to tell your story. Tell us about what you found.
So, in addition to the changes in South Lake Union, Amazon's presence has been felt with sort of a ripple effect out to the larger city of Seattle and beyond to the region. And one of the effects is that neighborhoods that are close to the center city that traditionally have been neighborhoods for people of color are now gentrifying as people with more money and means who tend to be white people are moving in. Austin Monique Sibilia grew up in Seattle's Beacon Hill neighborhood. She's a Filipino-American and was once part of a pretty strong Asian-American community there. But when it came time to find her own place, she couldn't afford it.
They're coming in strong and with money. It almost feels like a battle to, like, save our space or to, like, say, I'm still here and I still exist.
But, you know, we've heard that from a lot of people about their own particular neighborhoods and the changes they've seen there. The Central District is the historically African-American district. It's also close to downtown. It's seen a lot of changes. And then just up the hill from the Central District is Capitol Hill, which has been known and is still known as the gay neighborhood in Seattle. I myself spent a lot of time there in my early 20s. And in fact, I met my wife at the Wild Rose, which is the lesbian bar there on Capitol Hill. And, you know, I have to say, in recent years, I sort of cringe when I go back because, you know, it used to be this place where you'd go and it was all lesbians. It's a lesbian bar, right? The last time that I went back was a couple years ago, and I watched tech bros dance in the middle of the floor with very straight girls, and I wondered if they even knew where they were.
If it wasn't awful, as I can understand it would be for you, it's almost funny. Just the image of tech bros dancing.
The lanyard slap them in the face.
With that, let's move, if we can, to Posey's colleague, Caroline Chamberlain. Caroline Chamberlain was our colleague. She was a producer at KCRW, moved up to Seattle, is now at KUOW, where she's now podcast producer. You have spoken to a local historian who has tracked these changes and has a sense of Seattle's history. Tell us about that conversation you had.
Yeah, so I talked to Knut Berger. He says that Amazon is sort of the latest company town experience that Seattle's had, and it started with Boeing.
Without Boeing, we might not have had Microsoft. Without Microsoft, we might not have had Amazon. I mean, these things are all connected. And Boeing played a huge role in giving Seattle a tech identity, a future-oriented identity.
Boeing wasn't a completely positive experience for a lot of people in the city because in the late 60s, early 70s, Boeing crashed and a lot of people lost their jobs. So there was this feeling that we should never make ourselves this vulnerable to that kind of thing happening again.
So one of the cultural products of Seattle that came out of a period when it wasn't so affluent was grunge. I know you asked Knut Berger about that aspect of Seattle's change.
Given the cost of the city today, would Bezos come here and start a company in a garage? It doesn't feel like the city that would produce grunge. You know, we did back in the 80s and 90s, but now it's like everything that grunge made fun of or told us we should disdain.
Amazon was founded the same year that Kurt Cobain died. So in a way, you know, you could see that as a symbolic transition to the new Seattle.
By the way, where were you talking to Knut?
We were right outside of Whole Foods in South Lake Union. It's just a place where you can see the impact of Amazon on the city.
In what sense? Apart from it being the business that Amazon has now purchased that kind of signals this new direction for retail.
The Whole Foods is clearly designed for an in-and-out lunch crowd. You hurry to a booth, you hurry to a station to get your to-go food, and the cashier is right there. It's designed for a hurried, busy, stressed out tech worker.
That's Caroline Chamberlain. Back to Posy Gruner.
So what do people in Seattle suspect about the kind of city that Amazon might select?
I think people are having a lot of fun speculating about that. There's a real game show aspect to what's happening with Amazon. And, you know, you ask anybody here if they have an opinion about where Amazon's going to go next, they will have one for you. My coworker is certain they're going to go to Denver. I personally, my dark horse favorite is Philadelphia.
Why is that?
It's close to New York City, but it doesn't have the same sort of potential for future climate change as New York has. It's on the corridor. It's close to a pretty strong university system. It does not have the airport that Amazon is hoping for, but you can't have everything. But, you know, we've actually talked to a number of people, and Scott Galloway is one of them. He's a professor of marketing at NYU Stern and the author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And his take is that Amazon already knows where they want to go. They probably have a short list. They've got a very robust real estate network within Amazon itself, and they have a strong sense of their vision for the future. And this sweepstakes scenario is actually being used as a way to get the biggest incentives possible.
This is shaping up to be similar to an IOC bidding war, where there's a lot of high fives and intoxication around winning. And then perhaps over the long term, a lot of economists may be saying this wasn't a great deal for the host city.
Wow. So the upshot of that would be cities, hold your powder. Don't give away the house.
Exactly. And, you know, we heard that from Scott. We heard that from Richard Florida, the urbanist thinker who we spoke with about HQ2 as well. We've heard that from a lot of people.
I should say that we also spoke with Richard Florida, he of the creative class fame. And in fact, this is what he told us.
I don't think it's bad for cities to go for this. But every city who's asked me, I've told the same thing. Use this as an ability to build regional cooperation and collaboration amongst cities, counties, metropolitan areas, whatever municipal subdivisions. The second thing I say is use this as an opportunity to get to know Amazon. I'm making air quotes, to date Amazon. It's not just locating an HQ2, it's locating distribution facilities, warehouse facilities, manufacturing facilities, grocery stores, physical stores, logistics facilities. Maybe that fits your town. And thirdly, don't give them a dime in cash incentives, not one red cent. Do the things that you would otherwise do to make your community great and let Amazon know that. And on the other side of the equation, arguing to Amazon and Google and other tech companies that it is their economic and moral obligation to stop extracting from cities, seeing them just as a talent pool or a place to host workers or place companies, and to see them as a place to really build inclusive prosperity. These companies like Amazon pay their creative class and tech workers like gold, and they treat their service workers like dirt. They contract that work out. So I think it's in Amazon's interest to recalibrate and, you know, make a pledge to its winner city and all the other cities where it locates that we're going to be a great urban citizen with you. And I think that's the only way out.
That was Richard Florida. His latest book is called The New Urban Crisis. So Posy Gruner, back to you. We've been hearing quite a few of the negatives of having Amazon in your town. But what about all the upsides?
My family's from Seattle from 5 generations back. So I feel a really strong connection to this town. But when I was in my early 20s, right after college, I lived here for a few years. And then I decided to leave because Seattle at the time felt a little bit dull to me. And, you know, having come back in 2013 and seeing all the changes since then, there are definitely growing pains. But I feel like the city that I'm in now is a city that has a lot more to offer me than the city that I left in the early aughts. There are a lot of people that we've spoken to who have moved to Seattle because of Amazon, and they love the city. They are so appreciative of the opportunities that they've found here. But, you know, I think the thing that we're hearing from people in Seattle is that the opportunities aren't equally spread out.
Posy Gruner, producer of Primed, a new podcast that's exploring what happens when Amazon comes to your town, and Caroline Chamberlain, podcast producer, both of you at KUOW, our sister station in Seattle. It's so interesting to talk to you both about being part of Amazon HQ1. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frances.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And coming up after this break, we'll hear about a landscape architect who drew inspiration from the wilderness of California's high sierras and from the world of dance.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Look around you today and you will see that landscape design is transforming our infrastructure. The High Line in New York, for example, or the remaking of the LA River, or plans to cap our freeways. And you can find the roots of these environmental makeovers in the work of the great American landscape architect Lawrence Halprin. Halprin died in 2009, and now many of his parks are being neglected or altered, and his fans want to draw attention to his work. So right now, you can find around Los Angeles gallery shows, performances, and talks, all celebrating the work of Lawrence Halprin. And DNA producer Avishai Artsy has been learning more about him. Hello, Avishai.
Hello, Frances.
So tell us about his noteworthy works.
Yeah, I think you can break his career into three segments. So there's the early stuff. He started his firm in 1949 in San Francisco, and he got started by being commissioned by well-to-do clients to do their residential gardens. From there, he transitioned into the public realm, and he quickly started making these monumental modernist urban parks. These were made during a time of urban renewal. He wanted to breathe new life into city centers. This was when highways were being built, and a lot of people were fleeing urban centers for the suburbs.
What is so delightful about a Lawrence Halprin space?
Well, if you visit the parks that he's best known for, like Seattle's Freeway Park or Portland's Fountain Sequence, you can't help but want to climb inside them. They have big concrete blocks with water flowing over them, or flat concrete slabs laid out over water so you can jump from one to another. It reminds you a little bit of stepping over stones in a river. And that's his point. He's not trying to imitate nature, but remind you what it feels like to be in nature. I talked to Doug Moreland. He's an LA real estate developer, and he helped bring one of the Halprin exhibitions to Los Angeles. This is the one at the A plus D Museum of photographs of Halprin's work. He talked to me a little bit about the influence that nature had on Halprin.
Water features that he created are abstractions. You notice a lot of them are very blocky, but the power of the water coming over them, it reminds you of climbing on the rocks in the waterfalls. But they're not a replication of the waterfalls that you would see in the Sierra Nevada. That inspired him, but he used that to create a whole different design aesthetic, which was appropriate for the period of time he was doing his work.
And that period of time that he really got going was in the post-war years, when there's tremendous influence on architects from the Bauhaus and ideas about modernism and Le Corbusier, and Lawrence Halprin was certainly very influenced by that.
Some of his other projects were the master plan for the Sea Ranch community. This is up in Sonoma County along 10 miles of coastline. Famously, a project that environmentalists fought against and lost because they didn't want the coastline to be disrupted. And that led to the creation of the California Coastal Commission. Another big project of his later on in his life is the FDR Memorial in Washington, D.C. And then he also did a lot of work in Jerusalem. That constitutes the bulk of his work. Near the end of his life, he returned to the great outdoors, and he did a couple projects in San Francisco, at Pine Lake Park in the Presidio, and then a big one in Yosemite National Park.
In the late 80s and early 90s, Lawrence Halprin played a role in Los Angeles, specifically in efforts to sort of humanize the rather cold office towers of Bunker Hill in downtown. Just remind us about that period of his work, which has been called postmodern.
He worked for about a dozen years on a series of four projects along Hope Street in downtown Los Angeles. So at the south end, there's Grand Hope Park. This is on the campus of the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising. And then you have the Crocker Court Atrium, now the Wells Fargo Court, conceived as an urban indoor Garden of Eden. You have trees, fountains, water running through channels, and sculptures of dancing figures by Robert Graham. And then just a block away, you see a Robert Graham sculpture in the fountain at the top of Bunker Hill Steps, which leads from Hope Street down to Fifth. This connects the Bunker Hill area with downtown. You have an enormous concrete stairway bisected by a simulated mountain stream of what were rock-like concrete forms, but those rough rocks in the waterfall were replaced a couple years ago with smooth bricks. This gets into a whole other area in which Halpern fans are concerned that some of his parks are being altered and the design intent is being changed. This was supposed to make you think of a waterfall. Now it just looks like water flowing over bricks.
And we should just add that in addition to being taken from your office tower into a rocky, watery realm, you also got a lot of exercise on those steps. I believe those steps even had a nickname.
Yeah, it used to be called Cardiac Hill because of the enormous effort that it took to get from one place to another.
But the notion was that Halpern really wanted people to be outside breathing in the air and not sitting indoors at the base of your office tower eating a sandwich out of a brown bag.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if you wanted to cross the street on Fifth, you'd be at the LA Central Library, and there you'll find the McGuire Gardens, named after the developer Robert McGuire. So once you climb down those steps, you can eat your lunch in a nice shaded area and sit by the reflecting pools and the fountains there.
And in fact, Avishai, we went there just a few days ago to go and check it out, to re-immerse ourselves in the Halpern experience. And while we were there, we just happened to run into the Los Angeles choreographer Heidi Duckler. And she was leading her dancers in a rehearsal for a performance they're doing at the Gardens next week. Heidi's known for doing site-specific performances. She locates her dancers in interesting Los Angeles architectural spaces. So we asked her about why she picked this particular site.
Well, I'm from Portland, Oregon, so I grew up with one of Lawrence Halpern's most famous fountains and very dear to my heart. But I love all of his fountains. They're beautiful, wonderful political statements as well as being works of art. His fountains, you know, they're just so full of movement and of his work of traveling to the Sierras. And they're just so much about freedom in my mind.
And Heidi Duckler's dance performance at McGuire Gardens speaks to another interesting aspect of Lawrence Halpern, namely his wife, Anna Halpern, who is a renowned avant-garde dancer and choreographer. He borrowed from her the use of dance notation, and he applied it to the movement of people through a landscape. I actually talked to Anna about this. She's now 97 years old.
Larry was always interested in dance, you know, from the moment that he met me. And he felt that the sense of movement in the environment was a vital part of the design. Otherwise, the design would become very decorative. And he wanted his design to be activated. He wanted people to be active, to interact, not just, make pretty pictures.
Amazing. And she's still dancing, Anna, as I understand it, still leading performances in their house.
She still lives in their home in Marin County. And in fact, he built for her a large dance deck so she could still teach her dance workshops while raising their two kids. And the dance deck is very much still there, and she still leads workshops there to this day.
Fantastic. And he and Anna were a very close creative partnership, I understand.
Yep, not just life partners, but also in work as well. In the late 60s and early 70s, they co-led multidisciplinary workshops in the Bay Area, and that led to a methodology for collaboration that he called the RSVP cycles, or it's called also the take part process. So if a park is proposed, you get all the officials, neighbors, designers together and figure out the needs of the community and how the park might meet those needs. Here's how Charles Birnbaum, the president and CEO of the Cultural Landscape Foundation, described the impact that this process had on the field.
What Halpern is doing for landscape is he's creating a cyclical process where he recognizes that creativity, like nature, is not necessarily linear, but it's soliciting creative input from everyone, from artists to residents. This idea of kind of bottom-up planning, which is so central to every urban design project today that happens in the public realm, this is something that Halpern really popularized and brought to the discipline.
And just to place this in context, Francis, Halpern was doing this at a time of urban renewal. This is when planners are putting in freeways and tearing out neighborhoods with little public input, Bunker Hill being the perfect example. So it really was a radical idea for its time.
And to what degree did Halpern actually incorporate this input from the public into his designs? Because he was a very strong designer.
I mean, that's the thing. And this process really does have strengths and shortcomings. One issue with participatory design with this collaborative process is that of authorship and how much power the designer hands over to the public.
And if that results in a camel, as in a horse designed by committee, or something that really has coherence and strength and beauty.
I mean, that's the risk, right? I mean, I talked about this with Allison Hirsch, who teaches at USC School of Architecture and wrote a book about Halperin called City Choreographer. And she explained the hesitation that Halperin had with handing over that control.
Lawrence Halperin was a designer. I mean, he was trained by Bauhaus emigres at Harvard's GSD, or Graduate School of Design. And he had a strong design sensibility as well as a strong ego. And that actually was divergent from his wife, who was really interested in instigating sort of creative intuition and improvisation. And so their practices actually diverged despite their collaborations. But, you know, he had a hard time releasing his design agency ultimately. So he crafted the workshops very carefully. And, you know, at times in the book I talk about it being slightly manipulative or engineered, because he had, you know, longstanding values about the environment and how it should move into the future.
So while Lawrence Halperin is revered in landscape architecture circles, he's not without his critics. Personally, he had a reputation of being difficult to work with. Charles Birnbaum described him to me as irascible. And people will say that his brutalist concrete cubes seem a bit dated now.
Even though when you see the photographs that are on display at A+D Museum, they actually look so beautiful because they have now been softened by the plants that have grown up around them, and they look quite gorgeous. And I guess maybe I have a bit of a soft spot for brutalism. But he was influential formally, but based on what you've just been telling us, Avishai, it sounds like what also made him influential was this very human-centered approach to design.
Yeah, he really thought of himself much like a choreographer in deciding how people should move through a place, and he really wanted the parks and plazas to serve the needs of those people. At the 1990 dedication for the Bunker Hill steps, here's what he said. Great cities are not made by automobiles, freeways, and high-rises. Basically, they are made by open spaces and the people who use the open spaces.
We're talking about Lawrence Halperin because right now in Los Angeles, you have lots of opportunities to go see images of his work, dip a toe in some of his spaces, and hear people talking about his impact. Avishai, just remind us what's going on.
There's an exhibition of his photographs at the A+D Museum in the Arts District on view until the end of the year. There's a collection of his drawings, because he was a prolific sketcher and artist, on view for another week and a half at Edward Chella Art and Architecture at La Cienega in Washington. LA Conservancy is leading walking tours. There's the Heidi Duckler dance performance a week from today at McGuire Gardens at the LA Central Library, and a public symposium on November 4th featuring some of the architects and developers that worked with Lawrence Halperin over the years.
And you can get details on all these events by going to our website at kcrw.com/DNA blog. Avishai, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frances.
That was DNA's producer, Avishai Artsy. And while we're on the topic of design stuff to do around town, I do want to invite you all to an event coming up this weekend at the Barker Hangar in Santa Monica. It's West Edge Design Fair, and on Friday, I'll be co-hosting a day of talks about the massive disruption currently taking place in our cityscape, our transportation, retail, and much, much more. You'll hear from architect Michael Moltzen, Rose Apodaca, Architectural Digest Mayor Russ, meditation evangelists Susie Yaloff-Schwartz, and the creators of Platform, LA Co-Motion, and many others. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World coming up next.